This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This podcast interview is sponsored by TBI Corporation. Mobility, protection, response. TBI Corporation is the manufacturer of rapid deploy shelter systems, solutions for decontamination, isolation infection control, surge capacity, plus command control. For more information, visit www.tbicorp.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Commander Melissa Sanders, who is the branch chief for Hospital Bioterrorism Preparedness at the Health Resources and Services Administration. IHRSA is an agency of HHS, and for the past 4 years, its National Bioterrorism Hospital Preparedness Program has awarded funds to build the capacity of hospitals and other healthcare institutions to deal with large numbers of casualties. This year, the program is focusing on improving the capability of local and regional healthcare systems to manage mass casualty events. Commander, those are the areas of direct concern to our domestic preparedness subscribers, and I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today at headquarters.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the ability to talk to you all.
Well, with segment one, we want to talk about the status report of the National Bioterrorism Hospital Preparedness Program. And in July, I think, IHRSA announced the latest round of grant funds for the program. It was created after 9/11. So, Commander, may I ask you to give us an overview of the program, if you would? And my understanding is a $2 billion program, is it not?
That's correct, John. If you look back historically, since 2002, IHRSA has awarded cooperative agreement funds to the state departments of health in the total of $2 billion. You also correctly asserted that we were basically brought into existence after the anthrax attacks in 2002. So the focus of the program has very much been on bioterrorism. But early in the program, we realized as well that we needed to move to an all-hazards approach. So while the focus has been on bioterrorism, many of the plans and activities that we have the states look at benefit all-hazards preparedness and response as well. A brief overview of the program from 2002 through 2005 really dealt with capacity building. And as many of your readers will understand it in simple terms, that's really the stuff to respond to events. We focused very heavily on the idea of hospitals being able to surge beds, being able to surge personnel, pharmaceutical equipment, communications equipment, personal protective equipment, the gamut of what hospital-based personnel would be needing to take care of themselves and the patients that would be presenting to their facilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, now this year, the program will focus on improving the capability of local and regional healthcare systems to manage the mass casualty events. I guess that's different than the hospitals. I should ask you to explain the difference, if you would, and how that would affect the private and public health responders and receivers.
Right. Basically, what we did in 2006 is made a shift from capacity to capability. And what we're really asking the hospitals to do now is we still will have a focus on the ability of hospitals to acquire equipment and personnel and things that are needed to respond. We need to now make sure that the plans that we've been asking them to work on for the past 5 years are good plans that are based in the community with their emergency responder partners such as law enforcement, public safety, public health, and emergency management. So our focus really on this systems approach is in line with the Joint Commission requirements that hospitals plan with their communities for response activities. And we've provided more of a structured framework for the states on a tiered response system so that we have more of a common way that health and medical people will respond across the country and that emergency management would be aware of that so that they can help to the extent that they can.
In this segment, let's now look at some of the specific program priorities. Are we talking about things like expanding the number of hospital beds and developing isolation capacity at those hospitals?
We absolutely have been focusing on those efforts since 2002, continuing through 2006. In terms of beds, we look at that from multiple standpoints. We look at the ability for hospitals to increase their beds within their walls, so converting single occupancy rooms to double occupancy in the case of an event, or using cafeterias or staff space that may be available. We also, in 2006, very much tried to focus our efforts on outside hospital surge capacity. So the idea of providing hospital care in a setting that's not quite what people would be expecting, similar to the gymnasiums or schools or churches that might lend themselves to those kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. And certainly isolation for infectious diseases has been a very big component of our program since 2002, since we are more bioterrorism focused.
Now, I think this relates a little bit to the other priorities that you touched on in the previous segment. Let's talk about identifying the additional healthcare personnel who could be called up in a public health emergency. How are you approaching that?
Sure. We have a program of the NBHPP, which is called ESARVIP. It's a long acronym, and it stands for the Emergency Systems for Advanced Registration of Volunteer Health Professionals. What these are state-based systems that will quickly and ideally before an event identify volunteer healthcare professionals, have them registered, credentialed, and verified so that when an event happens at a state level, at a community level, or maybe in multiple states, as we saw in Katrina, that states have the ability to quickly call up verified volunteers and dispatch them across either their states or neighboring states that may be needing those personnel. That program focuses very heavily with the Medical Reserve Corps program, which is administered through the Office of the Surgeon General. I have a little less knowledge of that, but it's a volunteer, more of a similar to a Citizen Corps program, if you will. It's medical focused, but it's much more at the community level, and our ESAR program is very much at the state level.
Commander, what is what are you doing actually to support the hospital-based pharmaceutical catches?
Well, John, that's been another large focus of our program since 2002. What we've been able to accomplish in the past few years is that in the beginning, because we were brought into existence after anthrax, obviously the focus was very much on antibiotic therapy for exposure to drugs that would treat. So many of the states have gone about purchasing drug caches that are specific in the HRSA program for hospital-based personnel, their family members, as well as hospital-based EMS and their family members. I want to make a clear distinction that the CDC Strategic National Stockpile Program is another large pharmaceutical program that's geared more at the coverage of the general population. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure, and through some of the studies that American Medical Association has done, it's been very clear that if medical personnel aren't taken care of quickly and they have comfortability that their family can be prophylaxed quickly, the likelihood of getting them into or back to a facility is going to be very small. Mm-hmm. So we've been very conscious to make sure that states have the ability to purchase drugs. In 2006, we actually, through the events of Hurricane Katrina and Rita, expanded our program guidance to allow states to also start building stockpiles of routine medications that people will come to shelters in an event and say, I've been 3 days without my diabetic medication. Can I get some? Or I've been on heart medication. I've missed two pills. So certainly we are trying to expand the scope to say that if we're going to be hospital prepared, that means we need to be able to take care of people that present to shelters and to facilities.
Now, HRSA and the CDC collaborated to support ChemPak installation in hospitals, which relates to the stockpiling. ChemPak courses are containers filled with nerve agent antidotes. How is that proceeding?
It was going very well for approximately a year and a half. We certainly allow the states to use a portion of their HRSA-funded cooperative agreements for ChemPaks in hospitals. There's been some delay in the – they were resizing the packages of ChemPak. So there's been a little bit of a delay from our standpoint in getting the rest of the packs into the hospitals. But the timing of your question is interesting because we actually have a call with CDC and the ChemPak program next week to kind of get a status check and figure out how we can finish building out these ChemPaks into hospitals.
Do you want to say something about support for PPE, personal protective equipment?
We certainly have supported that in the past. We continue to support that through our program. One of the things I'd like to make your viewers aware of is that in the past, PPE, we don't provide definitive guidance at the federal level on what level of PPE states should be purchasing. We very much tell the states that we want it clearly linked to the hazard vulnerability assessments that hospitals have undergone and that public health has gone through. We don't want people buying inappropriate PPE or too much PPE or not enough PPE. Mm-hmm. So we certainly support the purchase of that. We just ask that it's clearly linked to their hazard vulnerability mm-hmm. assessments.
Now, what about HRSA support for portable or fixed decontamination systems?
Another major component that I think it's been quite an eye-opener for many of the hospitals to see these tents and systems show up in their parking lots, and they kind of look and say, wow, this is something new. What are we supposed to be doing with this? But clearly it was recognized in many communities, fire will not take the lead on decontamination. And in order for facilities to stay viable, they're going to have to know whether or not somebody's been decontaminated before they present and get them into their emergency rooms. If we had an infected or contaminated patient walk into an emergency room, we're effectively shutting that institution down. Mm-hmm. So many hospitals now have, many of them had in-house decontamination, but the ability to provide them with portable shelters where they could put a lot of people through in a short amount of time has definitely enhanced their ability to be more proactive. And for instance, just to give you a little case study on this, about 6 months ago, we got a report from Florida where a very rural hospital in the southern part of the state that serves a lot of migrant farm workers got a call. There was a pickup truck full of migrant workers that had been exposed to a white powder in the field. They were en route to the hospital. Because of the HRSA money that went for the unit itself, the PPE, and the training of the staff, they were able to have their decon set up prior to that truck arriving. They were able to decontaminate the men before they actually brought them into the facility. Mm-hmm. So we viewed that as a huge success for especially a rural hospital to have that ability.
Oh, that's great. Now, in this segment, I want to ask you a couple of questions about the HRSA role in planning for pandemic flu. I understand that you have a staff from the NBHPP program who held key roles in the development of the National Pandemic Flu Planning Guidance. Would you detail for us the HRSA input there?
Sure. I think I would probably rephrase the question a little bit to say we didn't have such an active role in plan in the actual plan development. We certainly had a very active role in the review of that plan. Mm-hmm. And there was people from across HRSA, not just my program, but the Office of the Administrator, Dr. Duke's office, had a very clear role in that, as well as some other people from across the different operating divisions within HRSA. Mm-hmm. Really what our role was when the Homeland Security Council put their matrix out with all the action items for the different agencies, HRSA clearly had a role in either defending the action items that were in there, questioning the action items that we weren't sure were really ours as a lead, and if we were going to be in the lead, helping to set the time frames for how we could achieve those action items that were in there. As well, we've been asked to work on different sub-working groups related to pandemic flu on issues that range from personnel to ventilator support and how we're going to be able to provide medical care with potentially scarce resources.
Can you restate or go into a little bit more detail about what deliverable emerged as it relates to hospitals and facilities and how HRSA will support it? I guess, is that the right way to phrase that question?
There were many deliverables that were put out directly to hospitals. HRSA has a role in a very few of those as far as being able to do direct services for the hospitals or have a direct impact. The action items that we had direct control over were one of the action items talked about our eSRVIP program and setting out kind of a national standard, if you will, a prepackaged system. So just recently, as of November 3rd, I believe, we set out draft compliance standards for all the states on what it means to have an operational eSRVIP system. And that actually fulfilled that action requirement. So now states and hospitals are in possession of the federal government's view of what it takes to have operational volunteer registry systems. The other direct deliverable for the NBHPP was providing guidance to states on using bed tracking systems. We provided that to the states in our 2006 guidance when we promulgated the use of another HHS document that had been put forth called Have Bed, which is Hospital Available Beds in Emergencies and Disasters. And what we did through our program is to start to standardize across the nation. Any state that puts into place bed tracking systems for hospitals, we're now ensuring that all of them are talking about a bed type the same way. Mm-hmm. So everybody talks about adult psychiatric beds the same way, or they talk about a medical surge bed the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those were the direct deliverables that HRSA was responsible for. In addition to that, we're not the lead agency, but we are certainly support to CDC on a number of activities to include infection control practices for hospitals, rapid diagnostic tests for hospitals, and we will basically serve as a clearinghouse where when CDC has those deliverables ready, we will get those out to the states, mm-hmm. to the hospitals, and the hospital associations.
Commander, I now have a couple of questions on how NBHPP supports training. Would you give us an overview of how the money would support not just training, but I guess education, drills, and exercises?
Certainly, John. Our program has allowed state departments of health the ability to focus training and exercises and drills more, again, at the hospital facility level. CDC provides a lot of training through their Centers for Public Health Preparedness for the public health workforce. HRSA has tried to target our money to hospital-based first receivers. Mm-hmm. So folks in the ERs, folks in the labs, we have provided training for lab personnel in the safe handling and packaging and shipping of suspicious agents. We've certainly provided a lot of hands-on training for clinicians in symptom recognition and treatment, as well as exercises in terms of drills that would routinely need to go on in hospitals, more community-based emergency preparedness drills and responses. We've been very focused with the program to make sure that hospitals understand that one of the requirements of the program is not only to conduct exercises within their facilities, but that we expect them to be involved in community-level exercises so that emergency preparedness, public health, law, fire are all aware of what the hospital's role is, and they're aware of what their responder partners are expecting of them and what they can count on those partners for as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take the recognizing and treating and the networking issues. I think moving a little further down what you just said, your priority has been to enhance the networking capacity.
Correct.
And training of the healthcare professionals and their ability, as you said, to recognize, treat, and coordinate care. Let's talk about it related to the behavioral health consequences. Can you speak to that issue?
Behavioral health has been a component of the program since the very beginning and continues to be. I think one of the things that we've recognized very early on is that numbers of people will decompensate in emergency situations that may have been indirectly affected but not directly affected. So certainly there's been an immense amount of attention paid to this. Probably not as much money paid to this as we certainly know needs to be. States are acutely aware, and actually some of our rural states have been very creative in how they have come around to providing behavioral health services.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the states are trying to work with their mental health partners at the state level to understand better the whole behavioral health and mental health care system in their states, to try to get money to those systems so that we can get them more at the table with us to help in planning and response activities.
Mm-hmm.
Many states will incorporate behavioral health components in their exercises and drills, and we certainly promote that, we encourage that, and to the extent possible, when we can find best practices, especially in behavioral health, we try to work with those states to get those best practices out. One more activity I would bring your attention to is SAMHSA is now in the process of developing some competencies, if you will, in behavioral health for emergency preparedness and response. And our program is very much at the table with them in that effort, helping to develop mm-hmm. those competencies.
In this segment, let's move to how HRSA supports jurisdictions who are working to secure and have secure and redundant communication systems. Now, I guess this would be for connectivity in a public health emergency. Mm-hmm. What have you all done, and what is the agency planning to do to help improve the connectivity among health care facilities and the state and local health departments, EMS, and so forth, as well as with the neighboring jurisdictions and the federal public health officials?
Well, that's a multi-layered question, and I can take some of it easier than I can take other parts of it. Certainly at the hospital facility level, we have supported the purchase of equipment for hospitals to be able to reach outside of themselves to public health departments, to law, to EMS. We've purchased many, many 800 megahertz systems. Some states have purchased satellite phones where 800 megahertz won't work as well. They've purchased repeater systems throughout their state so that if one tower goes down, they have backups. Certainly to the extent that we can get these systems interoperable with law enforcement, fire, and public safety, that's certainly the goal of our program. Department of Homeland Security, as you may know, has the lead for developing interoperability standards across emergency preparedness. We've been waiting for those standards to come out, but in the meantime, we've still allowed the purchase of systems. Public health departments have been very purposeful in trying to sit down with their first responder agencies in their states to say, what types of systems do you have in place so that we can purchase something that's as closely linked to you all as possible so that hospitals aren't kind of set adrift on their own in response.
Now, your agency is also using funds to increase the coordination of disease reporting among the hospitals and the local and state health departments, yeah?
Correct. We've encouraged hospitals to the extent possible. And again, this is more of a CDC role. They have their NEDS system is a disease surveillance tracking system. And whether a state has a homegrown disease tracking system or they're going to institute NEDS, HRSA supports the use of our dollars to get those systems into hospitals, to get people trained on how to use them, and to make sure that the feedback loop goes both ways, not just the hospitals reporting out, but that when the confirmatory diagnosis is made, that confirmation comes back to the hospital in a fairly quick manner so that they can start appropriate treatment.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about helping improve coordination and communication between public health labs and hospital-based laboratories?
Again, it's been a focus of our program. More of that has really focused at the CDC side. So they've probably done more on their side with public health getting the hospital labs up to speed. Most of the money at HRSA has been focused at training of lab personnel, and CDC takes more of the lead on the actual connectivity with public health and hospital labs.
Uh-huh. In our last segment, let's turn to NIMS compliance requirements. In September, the NIMS Integration Center promulgated compliance requirements for hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Commander, would you give us a little background on that? Because I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding in the hospital community about expectations. Has all that been cleared up?
I think we're still in the process of clearing that up. We certainly were through the HICS 4 working group. The NIMS Integration Center was at the table when HICS 4, which is the hospital incident command system, was updated for the fourth time this year. Through that, the NIMS compliance activities that have recently been released to hospitals were promulgated. HRSA had a very prominent role in the development of those activities, in making sure those activities were consistent with our program, and supporting hospitals at the state and local level to use our funding to get training in NIMS compliance activities. What happened in 2006 is we put out NIMS compliance expectations in our guidance that stated a due date for the states of September 30th of 2006. Since that happened, the federal government was a little bit long in actually getting the details to the states and the hospitals on what NIMS compliance meant. Mm-hmm. So what we've been trying to do very, very vehemently in the past few months is to tell the states, look, we know we had that date out there. We've had to move that back now another year because it took so long to get the actual activities and requirements out there. So we are still working with the state emergency managers, with the state hospital associations, to make them understand that for true NIMS activities compliance, the first reporting date on that for HRSA will be in federal fiscal year 2008. Mm-hmm. In other words, the new money we just put on the street September 1st, mm-hmm. we've prioritized some of those. There's, I believe, 17 activities, mm-hmm. and we prioritized four of those for the current funding cycle. Mm-hmm. So in calendar year 2007, our states will come in and tell us where they are in the continuum of getting hospitals compliant.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, can you say how the hospitals and facilities have responded to date? I mean,
so far, we've had a very good receptance of this mm-hmm. at the local level. Mm-hmm. Many of the hospitals started moving very early on to get their online training courses through EMI with the ICS 700 and 800 courses, as well as ICS 100 and 200. The other activity that we've mandated for the current funding cycle is that all of their standard operating procedures and emergency management plans will be in an ICS-compliant language. Mm-hmm. So we've certainly been working with the states to help kind of give more guidance on what that means. We've been trying to work with the hospitals to help them understand what that means. And so far, I think the receptivity has been very good.
Commander, one final question. How does NIMS compliance relate to the future funding programs that HRSA will be making available to the hospitals and healthcare facilities?
Excellent question. Certainly, through efforts with the NIMS Integration Center and through Department of Homeland Security, any future funding, probably starting with FY 2007 dollars, will be dependent on states and healthcare facilities demonstrating their ability to be NIMS compliant with the activities that are laid out through the HRSA Cooperative Agreement guidance on a yearly basis. If states are not able to give us that level of information, if facilities are not able to give us that information, the funding will definitely be in jeopardy mm-hmm. for those institutions. So certainly we at HRSA are committed to making sure that, you know, the program money is available to support those activities and that we get people NIMS compliant so they can continue to receive future funding.
Well, Commander Sanders, this has been a great interview, and I want to thank you very much for your time today. I know it's a busy schedule for you, and thank you so much for your service to the country.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.